This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The Rambam says the following at the end of Hilchos Melachim. Va'al ya'ale al da'etcho shehamelech ha-moshiach tzorich la'asois oisois u'moifsim. Don't imagine for a moment that the Mashiach is going to have to do miracles and wonders. U'mechadesh dvorim bo'ilom, and to create new things in the world. And to revive the dead, and other such things. Ein hadover koch, that is not correct. Sha'arei Rabbi Akiva chochem godol michochmei mishnah hayo. Because don't ever forget, says the Rambam, that Rabbi Akiva was one of our greatest sages. He was a Tana in the time of the Mishnah. V'hu hayo noisei keilov shel ben kuzibu hamelech. And he used to be a bearer for Bar Kochba. He used to carry the Bar Kochba's things around. Rabbi Akiva. V'hu hayo omer alav shehu hamelech ha-mashiach. And Rabbi Akiva used to say about Bar Kochba that he was the Mashiach. V'dimo hu v'chol chochmei doyrei shehu melech ha-mashiach. And he, Rabbi Akiva, and all the people of that generation believed that he was the Mashiach. Ad sheneherag ba'avoinos, until he was killed for sin. Kivan sheneherag, nodei Elohim she'eino. Only when he was killed for sin was it established that he wasn't the Melech HaMashiach. V'loi sholu mimenu chachomim lo'ois v'loi mo'ifes. And at no time did the Chachomim ask him to perform miracles to check whether he's the Mashiach or not. In other words, says the Rambam, it's a very rational process, this Mashiach business. And the person who is going to be Mashiach is not going to have to do any wonderful signs and wonders. On the contrary, im yamud melech mi beis David, should it happen at any time that a king, a leader, establishes himself and he is descended from the house of David, hoige batoiro, a person who thinks and is innovative in Torah, ve'oseik b'mitzvos k'David Oviv, and he is dedicated to the performance of mitzvos like David, his ancestor, kefi Torah shebichtav v'shebal peh, following both the written Torah and the oral Torah, ve'yochuf kol Yisrael leilech bo u'lechazek bodko, and he forces with his intellectual powers and with his influence the whole of the Jewish people to go b'derech ha-Torah, to keep the Torah, v'yelachim milchamos Hashem, and he fights the battles of Hashem, harei zeh b'chezka shehu Mashiach. We must assume that man is the Mashiach. It's an assumption. We don't declare him the Mashiach. There is an assumption. Just as Rabbi Akiva for a period of time assumed that Bar Kochba was the Mashiach. Im also v'hitzliach uvono migdash b'mekoimo, if he experiences success and he ultimately builds the Beis HaMikdash in its place, the kibetz nidche Yisrael, and he gathers all of the Jewish people to Eretz Yisrael, harei ze Mashiach bevadai, that's really the Mashiach. So the coming of the Mashiach is an evolutionary process, as the Rambam. It doesn't happen overnight. Although Chazal say it does happen overnight, it's possible that the declaration of the Mashiach is overnight. But a leader arises, we check that he's from the house of David, and he's a person who's totally dedicated to every meticulous detail of Torah, and he manages to sway the entire Jewish nation. That takes time. But when he gets to that point, Harezeh Bechezkas HaMashiach, we must assume that he's the Mashiach. And we wait to see whether he can build the Beis HaMikdash and get all the Jewish people together. It's a possibility. With Shabtai Tzvi as well, there were Chachomim, there were Gedolei Yisrael who considered the possibility very seriously that Shabtai Tzvi could be the Mashiach. And I think, if I remember correctly, it was the Mogen Avrom who sent a Talmud of his to watch everything that Shabtai Tzvi does. Go and watch him, spend some weeks with him, and come back and report. And the man came back and reported what a wonderful person Shabtai Tzvi was, and all the things he was doing, and all the people he was influencing. And the Mogen Avraham, I think it was the Mogen Avraham, said to his Talmid, "Did you watch everything? Did you ever see him putting on his shoes?" He says, "Yes, I saw him putting on his shoes." "How did he put on his shoes? His right one first or his left one first?" "He put on his right shoe first, and then he put on his right shoe first." And then he said, "And when he tied it, did he tie the left shoe first or the right shoe first?" Talmid says, "He tied the right shoe first." And then Avraham said, "Then he's not the Mashiach." It's a halacha, there's a law, you put on the right, and then you put on the left, then you tie the left, then you tie. If there's a halacha that he's not keeping, he's not the Mashiach. But it shows that until that time they were concerned of the possibility he might have been the Mashiach. The Ravid asks a question and says on the Rambam, and says, "Is it so clear that there's nothing supernatural about the process of determining who is the Mashiach and who isn't?" The Gemara says in Sanhedrin on the Tzadi Gimel Amud Beis, "Bar Kuzibo Molach Tartin Shnin Ufalgo. Bar Kochbo reigned." He led the revolt against the Romans in around the 2nd century CE. And he reigned for 2.5 years. Omar Luhu L'Rabbonon Anu Mashiach. And Bar Kochbo said to the Rabbonon, to the rabbis of the time, "I am Mashiach." Omrule, so they said to him, "Be Mashiach Ksiv, the Moirach V'doyin." Mashiach has a nose. That's what it says in Chazal. What does it mean Mashiach has a nose? He can smell right and wrong. He can, two litigants can come before him and he'll smell which one is the right one and which one is the wrong one. A person can be brought before a Beis Din accused of having done something wrong, and the Mashiach could smell, he had a nose for truth. Could smell. It doesn't mean he could smell with his nose. It means he had an intuitive sense of truth. That he didn't have to go through the whole process. He could immediately determine who was right and who was wrong. Next, the anonym, "Let's try you out on this." When they saw that Bar Kochba couldn't do that, they brought people to him who they know they had evidence about were wrong, people they had evidence about were right, and they asked Bar Kochba to judge with his nose, with his intuition, without knowing the facts. And Bar Kochba made a mistake all the time. He couldn't get it right. And it says, Katlu, they had him killed, they abandoned him, they allowed him to be killed, they lost all faith in Bar Kochba. They knew at that time that he wasn't the Mashiach. Asks the Ravid, so you see, they did ask him to do supernatural things. Why does the Rambam say that never did we ask, would we ask the Mashiach or a person who claims to be the Mashiach to do supernatural things? In order to resolve the Ravid and the Rambam, I'm going to use a principle that the Lubavitcher Rebbe Zatzal used in explaining something in this week's Sedra. He asks a question, and his questions on the Sedras, particularly on Rashi, were just too wonderful. The kind of questions that when you look at them, you think, my goodness, how could I have learnt the Rashi without asking the question? It's almost a childish question. It's so obvious. And yet you don't ask the question, and nobody asks them. And he asks that we're told in the beginning of the parasha that because of what Pinchas did, Lachain Emor, therefore say, says Hashem, Hinani noisein lois brisi shalom, I will give him my covenant of peace, v'hoyosol loy ulazaroy acharov bris kuhunas oilom, and for him and his children after him, I will give him the covenant of priesthood of kuhuna. Tachas asher kinei leilokov v'yechaper al b'nei Yisrael, because he executed punishment on behalf of Hashem, he punished Zimri. God was supposed to punish Zimri. Pinchas took it into his own hands and he executed the punishment, and because of that I give him my covenant of priesthood. Ask the Lubavitcher Rebbe, how can you give somebody a covenant of priesthood? Either you're a Kohen or you're not a Kohen. We told the story a couple of weeks ago of the man who was willing to give a large donation to become a Kohen because his grandfather was a Kohen. You can't become a Kohen. In fact, as Rashi himself says in Parshas Korach, and Moshe says to Korach, Korach wants to claim various positions for him, and Moshe says to him, "Boiker v'yoida Hashem es asher loy v'es hakadosh v'hikri ve'lov." In the morning, Hashem will make known who is his, who is the Holy One, and he will bring him close to him. And Rashi says there, Gevulois chilek HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba'ilama. Hashem divided his world with boundaries. Yecholim atem la'afoich bo'ikir le'erev. Can you turn morning into night? Kein tuchlu levatel lezu. That's how easy it is to change around who's a Kohen, who's not a Kohen. These are natural things. They're by birth. There's a natural, when Hashem gave kahuna to Aharon and his children, he gave it to them, and he gave them a natural genetic tendency towards priesthood. And priesthood is not something you can become. It's not, that's not what it is. You can't transmutate and become a Kohen. You either have the genes of kahuna, or you don't have the genes of kahuna. How can Hashem give kahuna as a reward? Because of what you did, you'll become a Kohen. Where do we find such a thing? And although Pinchas was really from the family of Aharon, he was descended of Aharon, he was a grandson of Aharon, nevertheless, when the kahuna was given to Aharon, it was given to Aharon and any children of his yet to be born. But it wasn't given to the children of Aharon who were already born, to the descendants of Aharon who were already born at that time. At this time, so Pinchas was not a Kohen at this time, until he killed Zimri. And for that, Hashem says, now you can become a Kohen. Ask the Lubavitcher Rebbe, how can you dish out kahuna as a reward for acts that you've done? That's not how you get kahuna. Wonderful question. And he explains, and I'm only giving a very small part of it, that there is an energy, we've spoken before, about the energy of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And what that is, in the Oyer, it's called light. In Parshas Bereishis, we spoke about it at the beginning of the Torah, what light means and what that energy means, and that's the source of all creation, and we can only grasp certain aspects of it. We can't understand it fully. But that energy is something that the Ribbono Shel Olam has. That's part of the essence of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And we down here are able to get aspects of that energy. But there are two different ways of getting those that energy. The one way we call is a hamshocho milamailo lamato. We're able to draw it down from Hashem. We're able to draw down some of that energy, and we're able to benefit from it here. In Kabbalah, it's explained that if that energy were to come down immediately to us, there's no way we could survive it. It's like standing next to a nuclear explosion. We would be blown to pieces. It's not possible. So as this energy comes down, it comes down in protective layers. And it comes down insulated so that we don't get the full blast of that energy, because we wouldn't be able to cope with it. And the lower it has to come, right down to our levels, which are right down at the bottom, it has layer upon layer upon layer of insulation. But still, we can bring it down. There's another way altogether, which is ha'alo milamato lamano. We can actually generate some of that energy within ourselves. And we can, so to say, transport, we can radiate that energy upwards. So there are two different dynamics of this energy. On the one hand, the energy that comes from Hashem comes from the real source, but it comes down with lots and lots of layers. The energy that comes from within ourselves is from within us, but it doesn't have all those layers. It's a different kind of energy. Now the Baal HaTanya talks about the ultimate being, the state that will exist after Mashiach comes. Tachlis Brias Oilom Hazeh, Hu Shinisaveh HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Li Yos Loi Diro B'Tachtoinim. Alatanya quotes a Chazal that the Ribbono Shel Olam wants a presence in the lower worlds. In these worlds, Hashem doesn't want us to be alienated from Him. He wants a presence in this world. The term, says the Baal HaTanya, of upper worlds, lower worlds, doesn't really apply to Hashem. Because Hashem fills all the worlds. It really doesn't make, there's no upper and lower and bigger and smaller. These relative terms don't apply to Hashem. Before the creation of the world, Hashem was single and unique. There was nothing but Hashem. And all this place taken up by the world was filled only by Hashem. There wasn't anything else in the world. And the truth is, it's still that way. From Hashem's perspective, it's still that way. Rak she'ashinui, the change that happened when the world was created, hu el ha'mekablim, chayuso v'oiro. From our perception, things have changed. We look around and we see buildings and we see trees and we see land and we see all sorts of things which isn't Hashem. She'mekablim ayidei levushim rabim ha'mechasim u'mastirim oiro yisborach. We get Hashem's energy through many layers of insulation. That's what's changed. So although Hashem's energy is still here in its full power, we are not exposed to Hashem's energy in its full power. And he goes on to explain that ultimately the desire is to get things back to the point where we are able to be exposed to Hashem. And he says, for example, that happened momentarily during the time of Matan Torah. When the Torah was given, we were exposed to Hashem in all His energy. We actually came face to face with the power and the energy of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the next time that there will be such an event will be Tachlis Hashlemus Hazeh, the state of completion, of fulfillment, will be Shel Yomos HaMashiach U'Tchiyas HaMesim, will be the time that Mashiach comes. Shehu Gilui Oyer Ein Sof Baruch Hu Ba'olam Hazeh HaGashmi. That is when the Ribbono Shel Olam will be able, so to say, to reveal His full energy in this physical world. Asked the Lubavitcher Rebbe, what was the difference then, or what will the difference be, between Matan Torah, where yes, we were exposed to the energy of Hashem, wonderful, wonderful, and what happened the next day? We were dancing around the golden calf. What guarantees do we have that after Mashiach comes and once again we're exposed to the energy of Hashem, that we won't deteriorate once again? What's going to change? And to explain that, he explains the concept of Pinchas. What is this Pinchas? What's so special about it? And Chazal say, Pinchas is Eliyahu HaNovi. Pinchas never died. Pinchas is Eliyahu HaNovi. He transmutated into Eliyahu. And he's the one who will actually announce the coming of Mashiach. So Pinchas is the link between the times of the Torah, the past, and the times of Mashiach, the future. He is the link between the first coming into Eretz Yisrael, which this whole Sedra is about, appointing a successor to Moshe in this week's Sedra, the most Slovchod, the Yerusha of Eretz Yisrael, breaking Eretz Yisrael up and giving it to the people who are coming in. This Sedra deals with coming into Eretz Yisrael, and Pinchas is very much a part of all that. Is the link between that and between the Geula HaSido, the ultimate redemption of coming into Eretz Yisrael when the Mashiach comes. Pinchas is the link. Why Pinchas and what is the linkage? And the Lubavitcher Rebbe explains, and I'm going to go into slightly Kabbalistic terms for a moment, that the human soul has four parts to it that function normally. And they're linked to the four different insulations that divide us from this energy that we're talking about, from the Ribbono Shel Olam. There's nefesh. It's called nefesh. That's our body, is our life. Is the lowest level of the spiritual personality. There's ruach, which is the next level, spirit. There's neshama, which is soul. And there's chayo, which is the ultimate of life. Similarly, we have in the world also has its four stages, its four levels, that link each one to an aspect of the personality. And let's look at the linkage. The first one is asi, or the practical world. What do we use? In what way do we interface with the practical world? We use nefesh. We use our lowest form of life. Our life force, our bodies that can do things, that can implement things, that can calculate things in the simplest sense. That we use our nefesh, we use our human life force to involve ourselves on the level of asi, or doing things. The practical side of the world. The next level is Yitzira. That's already slightly creative, where we start forming things, where we're able to take things and impose an order on the world, move things around, put things into a hierarchy of value systems. For that we use Ruach, for that we use our spirit. The practical side of the human being cannot prioritize from a value point of view. To prioritize and to formulate ideas, you need Ruach, you need the next level. This is the human spirit. Then there comes, after formulation, there comes Bria, which is creativity. To be truly creative, for that you need soul, you need neshama. So you've got life, spirit, and soul. To be truly creative, you're utilizing the soul in the human being, not the spirit and not the life. And ultimately there's Atzilus, which is almost the spiritualization, being able to relate to the spiritual content of all physical things, and to be able to deal with things at their essence. And for that you need the fourth level of the personality, the Chayo, that which is the highest form of life altogether. That explains in the Lubavitcher Rebbe there's a fifth level, which we very seldom get to. And that's Yechido. That's the ultimate oneness, uniqueness, which links in with Yochid, with the Ribbono Shel Olam singularity. So that if you really want to tune into, not anything over here, but if you want to tune into God Himself, that's the fifth level. And this is where Pinchas did something unique and unusual. Zimri was having a public relationship with a non-Jewish princess. Pinchas, without asking, takes a spear and kills the two of them. For doing that, he could have been killed. He had no halachic right to do it. He had no legal right to do that. He's taking the law into his own hands. And for that, he could be killed. If anybody watching would have killed Pinchas on the way, they would have been entitled to do so. So Pinchas kills Zimri and the non-Jewish princess, knowing that that would probably cost his life. It didn't in the end, but it would probably cost him his life. In so doing, he's using the ultimate form of Mesiras Nefesh, of giving his life for something he believes is right. But there are two levels of believing of Mesiras Nefesh. The one is that everything you do with Mesiras Nefesh. You do with enormous dedication. There's a mitzvah to learn Torah, so you learn even though you're very tired, you learn even though you're very poor, you learn even though it's very difficult. You do it with Mesiras Nefesh, you sacrifice yourself in the process of studying Torah. There's a mitzvah to give tzedakah, to give charity. It's hard for you, you've got commitments to meet, it's difficult, but you give tzedakah nevertheless. That's Mesiras Nefesh, you're doing it with dedication. And so all the other mitzvahs, every mitzvah, in other words, Mesiras Nefesh is a dimension of performing the mitzvahs. That there are certain mitzvahs that you keep, and you can keep it with Mesiras Nefesh. It's a form, it's a style of the way you keep the mitzvahs. But there's another level altogether of Mesiras Nefesh, explains the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and that is to do things beyond what the halacha requires. To do things that are in fact almost non-halachic. For example, Pinchas. If Pinchas would have asked the Shaila, had Pinchas come to Moshe and said, Moshe, I've got a spear in my hand. Look what Zimri is doing. Shall I kill him or not? Moshe would have been obligated to answer, no. The halacha is that you don't kill him. And Pinchas wouldn't have been able to do it. But Pinchas took the law into his own hands, which, by the way, there are a lot of conditions before that can be done, and there are not people today who are on that level at all. We're talking about a virtually superhuman level, and it's theoretical, not practical, so please don't go around killing people that are doing wrong things. And still saying that Rabbi Lapin said that's the ultimate level of Yiddishkeit. But for Pinchas, what Pinchas did was almost go beyond the boundaries of the halacha. He actually broke forth into something supernatural. And in fact, the Chelkas Mechokek in Evan Oezer, in Simon Tezayin, asked the question. Evan Oezer there says, in fact, that explains what happens if a Jew and a Gentile are having, if a Jewish man and a Gentile woman are having a relationship, and he wasn't killed by somebody like Pinchas. Then he explains what exactly happens to the person. Ask the Chelkas Mechokek, but why doesn't the Shulchan Aruch say that if there's somebody like Pinchas around, he should kill him? And he doesn't answer it. The Chelkas Mechokek doesn't answer it. Answers the Lubavitcher Rebbe, because it can't be included in the body of halacha. The whole point of what Pinchas did is that he went beyond the body of halacha. If there was such an instruction in halacha, you would be depriving Pinchas of everything that he did. The essence of what Pinchas did was that he was able to go beyond the body of halacha and do something right, even though it was beyond the body of halacha. It's easy to go beyond the body of halacha. People do it every day of their lives. They talk Lashon Hora and they break Shabbos and they keep track. We're not talking about that. We're talking about breaking the boundaries of halacha and being right about it. Doing something that it doesn't say in the Shulchan Aruch and being right that it's the right thing to do under those circumstances. That was Pinchas. And therefore explains the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Pinchas was doing two things. Halacha is when we look at the law, when we look at the Torah and work out from that how to act, what are we doing? We're bringing down the energy from the top to the bottom. The Torah is the energy, the Torah is the channel, and through the Torah we're figuring out how to act. So we're looking in the Torah and we're bringing God's energy down into this world. But to do a Pinchas, to be able to be innovative in halacha and create a halacha which doesn't even exist in Shulchan Aruch and be right about it, to be authentic about it. That's from inside. That's beyond the bounds. That's Mesirus Nefesh. That's a different level of Mesirus Nefesh. That's breaking all natural bounds. That's doing something totally unnatural. You're creating an energy from within yourself, a true and a genuine energy, and sacrificing, being willing to sacrifice your life for that. That's a different level of energy. And so he says, Pinchas had a combination, a unique combination of both. Not only was he able to bring Torah down from heaven, which Moshe did, and which Aaron could do, and all the Gedolei Israel are able to do, but Pinchas was able to generate certain aspects of Torah from within himself. And he was able to sacrifice his life, or to be willing to sacrifice his life for it. And therefore he says, Pinchas got a special type of kahuna. Pinchas had the genetic qualities of kahuna. He was a descendant of Aaron. There was a technical problem. He was born too early. But the genetic qualities he had. He wasn't made a kohen until he did something to deserve it. And what he did was breaking those boundaries, developing that energy from within himself. So kohen, Pinchas was a man who synthesized two different forces. The force of nature, he had the natural elements of kahuna, and he had the creative force from within himself, the supernatural elements of kahuna. And Pinchas, and only Pinchas, combined those two in one person. And that explains, for the Babbage Rebbe, is the difference between how we experience Matan Torah and how we will experience the coming of Mashiach, the Geulah HaSidur. When the Torah was given to us, it was entirely from top to bottom. All the energy came from up at the top. We had developed nothing really from within ourselves. There was no Mesirus Nefesh from within ourselves. On the contrary, as we know, people fell asleep that night. There was no dedication. There was no act of going beyond the bounds of halacha from within ourselves. It was all energy. We were passive in the process. If you're passive in the process can be very dramatic, but not long-lasting. In the Havdil, they've discovered that television is not a powerful form of advertising, contrary to all beliefs. It's a powerful form of advertising only for a few seconds. And that's why you'll find now in television advertising, they give you a telephone number and they say, phone now. To show you a product, and they give you the price, and they say, phone now. Because they know if you don't phone now, the impact is gone. No matter how powerful the advert. Whereas radio and newspaper advertising has a much longer term impact. It's more subtle and it's more longer term. For a very simple reason. For radio and newspaper, you have to use a little bit of imagination. Not very much, but a little bit of imagination. For television, you use no imagination. There's nothing from within you. It's all totally external. You're sitting passive and you're being bombarded with images. While you're being bombarded, the impact is very great. It's very dramatic. But there's nothing left afterwards. Nothing at all. And so it was, L'Havdil Elef Havdolos, with the first Matan Torah. There was an enormous dramatic impact when Hashem revealed Himself, but they did nothing for it. They weren't generating the energy. The energy was coming from Hashem. And therefore, when the act was over, they were back to normal. They were left with nothing. There was no real experience within themselves. And Pinchas teaches us that the link between that and the Geulah HaSidur, the coming Geulah, is going to be different altogether. That's going to be something we're going to generate energy for. That Mashiach will come not just through the actions of external forces, but Mashiach will come through our actions. As the Baal Tanya says in the very next chapter, that this wonderful thing about the coming of the Mashiach, Tolui b'ma'aseinu v'avodoseinu, calls man Meshech Hagolus. The coming of the Mashiach depends on our deeds and our dedication to Hashem all of the time that we're in the Golus. We're in exile. Ki hagoyrem tzchar ha-mitzvah hi ha-mitzvah ba'atzma. Because that which causes the reward of the mitzvah is the doing of the mitzvah. Ki ba'asiyoso mamshich ha-odom gilu oyre en soif baruchu melamala lamata. Because by doing the mitzvah, we bring down Hashem from the upper reaches down to the lower reaches. So the obligation is on us. We're going to have to do it. And the fact that we're going to have to do it will guarantee it's long lasting. That's going to be the difference. And that's the message of Pinchas. Pinchas is the only Kohen that didn't get his kahuna from birth. Just happened to be born a Kohen. Only one. He's the only Kohen who worked for it and got it as a reward for what he did. He was the only Kohen who synthesized both the gift from above and the striving from below, and was able to create that dual energy within himself that makes him the link between the past and the future, that makes him the link between that era and the era of the coming of the Mashiach. That's how he explains the concept of Mashiach. What does that mean? What it means is that in Pinchas there was an enormous sense of intuitiveness of what's right and what's wrong. And that intuitive is something, that intuitiveness is something that is not externally motivated. You can't get intuition from outside. As long as an idea remains outside of you, it doesn't become intuitive. You can know it, but it's not intuitive. There's a big difference between absorbing intuitively, internalizing an idea, and making it a part of you. There's a big difference between that and between merely knowing it. Rebbe Lopion, my great uncle, used to tell his Talmidim that he doesn't mind if they use his material. And they don't even have to quote his name when they use his material. But there's one condition, he used to say. Don't use any of my material until, he used to say, it's gone through your whole digestive system, every pipe of your digestive system. And it's gone through every blood vessel of yours. So that it's no longer mine, it becomes yours. Then you can quote it, then you can use it, and you don't even have to quote my name. But until that time, please don't quote me. Just don't quote, otherwise you get happening what I told you about at the beginning of this year. Don't quote information, because one doesn't truly understand it until it's integrated. And you haven't integrated until you've worked with it and battled with it and struggled with it and been creative with it. That's when you become able to do so. That was Pinchas's message. A combination of a hamshocho milamalo lamato, the combination of being able to attract knowledge from the Ribbono Shel'olam, energy from Hashem down to us, and ha'alo milamato lamalo, and being able to elevate that knowledge from within us back to the Ribbono Shel'olam. It's a two-way dialogue. Pinchas was the master of that. And that really helps us understand the Ravid's question on the Rambam. The Rambam said Mashiach will not be asked to do anything supernatural. Asks the Ravid, but we see in the Gemara in Sanhedrin that Bar Kokhba was asked to make a legal decision just by having a look at the litigants and smelling them, just by an intuitive sense. What we would answer on the basis of this understanding of the Lubavitcher Rebbe is that's not supernatural. That's perfectly natural if one's on the level. Mashiach will also have the qualities of Pinchas. Mashiach will also be somebody who not only knows Torah externally, but knows it internally, and has an intuitive sense and understanding of what is right and what is wrong, what is true and what is false. He will be, and that's the test, not how much he knows. Not a knowledge test. We're not going to give him a multiple choice question sheet on the whole of Shas to check if he's Mashiach or not. Doesn't say that anywhere. We want to see if he has an intuitive knowledge of what's right and wrong. Does he have an intuitive knowledge of what's true and false? Does he have an intuitive knowledge of what the Torah allows and what the Torah doesn't allow? That's the test. To what degree is it internalized? And so when Bar Kokhba was examined, it's not as the Ravid says that this was some magical kind of thing. Let's see whether magically you know who's right and wrong. No, says the Rambam, that's perfectly natural for somebody who's absorbed the Torah within himself to such a degree. He should develop that intuitive sense of being able to understand what's right and wrong without necessarily going through the rational process. That doesn't mean he's allowed to do it, by the way. That's not the way he makes legal decisions. The Mashiach will have to make legal decisions using normal halachic criteria. But he should have the ability to penetrate directly, using his own intuition, to penetrate directly to what's right and what's wrong. Now, a similar concept is developed by Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz from a completely different perspective, and in that we'll understand some of the conflicts that have arisen around the persona of the Lubavitcher Rebbe Zatzal and his movement. And this year is different from others because I'm dealing with a controversial issue. The Lubavitcher Rebbe and his movement has been a controversial issue. And this year is not one that I'm trying to, or going to attempt to tell you who was right and who was wrong, and what is right and what is wrong. All I'm going to try to do is to clarify for you how I, in my mind, deal with it. If that is of use to you, use it with pleasure. If it's not of use to you, forget it. Then ignore it. It's not one of these shiurim where I'm willing to fight with you, to convince you, because I'm absolutely certain that what I'm saying is 100% true. I don't think it's so clear. I don't think anybody can be so absolutely clear in a controversy of this nature to know exactly what is right and what is wrong. We can just try and come to terms with what the issues are and try and understand those issues a little better. The Gemara in Sukkah Daf Kaf Ches says that Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus was asked what he attributes his longevity to. And he answers, Lo yomarti dovar shelo shomati mipi Rebbe Meir. I attribute my longevity to the fact that I've never said a thing that I didn't hear from my Rebbe. All I've said, I've heard from my Rebbe. I didn't innovate. Seems to be what it means. Ask Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz, there's a fascinating story in Ovos de Rabbi Nosson in the 6th Perek. But it says that Hyrcanus, the father of the same Rabbi Eliezer, prohibited his son from learning Torah. But nevertheless, Eliezer, when he was 22 years old, decided to go and learn. Shoma olav Hyrcanus oviv shehoyo loymei Torah to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Hyrcanus, his father, heard that he was learning Torah by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Omar, he said to himself, Eilech ve'adir Eliezer b'ni menechosai. I will go to the yeshiva of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and in public I will make an oath that my son Eliezer will have no benefit from any of my property. Omru, they say, Oysu ayom Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai yoshev v'dorish b'Yerushalayim. That day Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was giving a shir in Yerushalayim. So you can imagine what it was, you can imagine who was there. All the Gedolei Yisrael were there. All the Tannoim were there. You can imagine what kind of Noilim it must have been, a huge crowd that had come to listen, but a crowd of great people had come to listen to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. The whole Gedolei Yisrael Yeshivin Lefonov, all the Gedolim of Israel, all the great people of Israel were sitting before him. Shoma Olav Shebo, he heard that Hyrcanus was coming. Hoshiv Lo Shomim, so he got some people to take care of, to watch Hyrcanus, that he shouldn't get out of hand. Omaloim, and he said to the gods, in Bole Shev Al Tenichu, don't let him just sit down, keep watching. Who Bole Shev Al Tenichu? They wouldn't let him sit down, they didn't want him there. But say he went and found, and he walked until he found a free spot. Until he found himself a space between these three great people. And he sat down there. Hyrcanus, the father of Eliezer, Umarasis, and he was trembling. Omru, the story goes that Oysa Hayoim Noson Enov Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai b'Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai got up now in the presence of all the Gedolei Yisrael, and they've all come to listen to him. And he looks around the room, and he picks on Rabbi Eliezer, and he points at him. V'omaloi Psach v'drash, and he says, Eliezer, you give the shir today. Come forward, you give the shir today. I'm taking it easy. Amalei ini yochel iftach. Forget it, I can't do it. Dochak alav, he forced him, he pressured him, v'duchaku atalmidim, and everybody said, yeah, we want Eliezer. Omar dufosach v'dorash, he got up and he gave a shir, b'dvorim shelo shamaton oizen me'ilom, and he said things that no human ear had ever heard before. And every time he said something new, Omer Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the great Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, got up from his seat, Araglov, and he got onto his feet, and he came up to Eliezer and he kissed him. V'amaloi Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi, and he called him Rabbi Eliezer, my teacher. Emes limadatani, you've taught me something true. Actually, he gives man latzeis, before the time to leave arrived, Omar Hyrcanus oviv araglov, Hyrcanus got up onto his feet for Omar, and he said, Rabbeisa, gentlemen, aniloi bosi ilo lahadir Eliezer b'ni menechasai. I came here to make an oath that my son Eliezer will get nothing from my property. Achshov yu nesunin Eliezer b'ni, v'chol echo p'turim v'ein loim klum. Now I want to declare that my entire estate belongs to Eliezer, and his brothers have no claim on it. Be that as it may, ask Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz, this is the same person who said, never in my life have I said anything that I didn't hear from my Rebbe. And here we have a story how the Rebbe himself kisses him every time and says, you've taught me new things. And he was saying things, Shalosh Shomo is in Ma'ilam, what is it? explains Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, when Eliezer, when Rabbi Eliezer says Lo yamati dovash lo shamati mipi Rebbe Meilam, I've never said anything that I haven't heard from my teacher, he doesn't mean I'm an imitator. He doesn't mean I simply copy what I see other people saying and doing, or that I simply give out what I heard from my teacher. That's not what he means. Of course he's innovative. Of course he's original. That's a human responsibility, to be innovative and original. However, he was given that same kind of reyach or emes, just as we talked about the way that that Bar Kokhba was checked, and he didn't have the smell of truth, the intuitive knowledge of truth. What Eliezer meant was, I've said lots of new things, but I'm satisfied that they're the kind of things my Rebbe would be satisfied with, would be pleased with. How do you know that without checking? For that you need an intuition. To be able to be creative, to be able to formulate a brand new idea, and be satisfied that although you never heard such a thing from your teacher, you know that your teacher would approve. It's the kind of thing he would say. And I've often told in the Beis HaMedrash how it happens that I'm preparing a shir, and I've got something really good to say. So there's a Gemara shir, it really seems fantastic. And I always, as I prepare a shir, I go through and I simulate in my mind my saying it over to my Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal, to my late Rosh Yeshiva. And occasionally I see him squiggle his nose in my mind, in my imagination. When he used to say something he wasn't all that keen on, his nose used to twitch. That's all. If he really didn't like it, he would tear you to pieces. But sometimes his nose would twitch and he wouldn't say anything, and you knew then it wasn't any good. And sometimes I would say over what I want to say, and I would see the face of my Rosh Yeshiva and I would see his nose twitch. And I would abandon the idea, I would abandon the concept. It's necessary to be able to be innovative, but it's necessary to have a frame of reference. It's necessary to have an intuitive idea of whether what you're saying is right or wrong. And that's what's terribly important. You can have proofs from all over the place. I can prove to you from Chazal that communism is right. I can prove to you from Chazal that communism is wrong. I can prove to you from Chazal that capitalism is right. I can prove that capitalism is wrong. I can prove anything you want from Chazal. There's nothing you can't prove if you want to twist and turn. Anything you want. But there has to be an intuitive knowledge of when something's right and when something's wrong. When you're saying something, it's not that 100%, but most of the time you need to develop the capacity to know the chances are it fits in, it's integrated, it's part of the Torah, it seems to be right. And today we've moved very far from that. Today everything's become so scientific, like doctors probably have the same thing. The old style GP didn't used to do all the kinds of tests that the modern GP does. Today if you go into a GP, very often with a small complaint, he sends you to have 50 blood tests. And from the blood test, he determines what's wrong with you. The old style GPs used to work differently. They didn't have access to all these blood tests. I remember once when I was a little child, my mother took ill, and our doctor, our house doctor, was away overseas. And I remember medical conferences taking place in our house, specialists coming to figure out what was wrong with her, and all the tests. And none of they couldn't agree what was wrong with her. And she eventually got fed up and she wrote to the GP. She wrote a letter about how she feels. And he wrote back and he said, it's yellow jaundice. And when he came back, the other doctor said, but how did you know? Because it proved to be right. He said, no, I know my patient and I know that if she wrote that way, I could put two and two together, that the only thing that would cause her to feel that way is yellow jaundice. I know that's how she is. An intuitive knowledge, it must be right. We've come to be reliant on facts, on information, on looking back. We've got indexes and we've got ways of checking with Chazal and we've got computer printouts. We do it in business, we do it in the professions, and we're doing it in Torah. Substituting an intuitive feeling for what's right and what's wrong with scientific proofs, bringing 10 proofs here and 15 proofs there and so on. That's not the way that the Gedolei Yisrael used to work. I told you the story of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who claimed not to be a boki, not to be familiar with all of Shas, which wasn't true. I'm sure he was very familiar, but that wasn't his strength. His strength was being able to penetrate to the essence of the issue and to really unravel an issue from within. And he was giving a shir once, and one person in the shir said, but you can't say that which you've just said. There's a Tosfos on such and such a page and such a Masechta that says the opposite. And Reb Chaim simply said, that's nonsense, and he carried on the shir. And afterwards the young man came up to Reb Chaim and said, I'll show you the Tosfos. He said, please do. The young man brought him the Tosfos, and Reb Chaim showed him that he didn't understand the Tosfos at all. That's not what Tosfos means. And then Reb Chaim is reputed to have said to the young man, it's not that I knew there wasn't such a Tosfos. How can you be sure that there isn't such a Tosfos? I knew there couldn't be such a Tosfos. That's what I knew. I knew intuitively it's not possible that Tosfos would say such a thing. That's what's important. That's an internal intuition that has to be there. And Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz explains, that's what you get from a Rebbe. You don't get knowledge and information from a Rebbe, you can get that from books. But to develop the intuition of when something's right and when something's wrong, when something's straight and when something's crooked, that's what you get from a Rebbe, that's what you get from a teacher. And that's what Eliezer ben Hurkanus meant. I've never said anything that I'm not 100% sure that my Rebbe would have approved of, although everything I said was innovative, everything I said was new, everything I said was my own. But I knew intuitively that my Rebbe would approve of it, and if not, I've never said it. That's what I attribute my longevity to. So here also we see this concept of internalized Torah and external Torah. Torah which remains a body of knowledge and a body of information, or on the other hand, Torah which becomes part of the intuitive consciousness of the human being. But there is a condition with all this innovation, and that is that it's lo yamati dovah shelo shamati mipi Rebbe me'ilom, that although it's innovative and new, it fits in with the old. It's integrated with the old. It isn't a departure. It's innovative, but it's not departing from what was done before. Now, we've unfortunately lost two great Hasidish Rebbes. The one was the Lubavitcher Rebbe Zatzal, and the other was the Klausenberger Rebbe Zatzal, who also died a fortnight ago. Very great Hasidish Rebbe. And one of the reasons I decided to mention both tonight is because I'm disturbed about the success in a sense, or disturbed in a sense about a success of the public relations of the Lubavitch movement. It's all very well to promote the greatness of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, which they did very effectively, but it was such a good campaign that if you say to somebody, what's the Rebbe's, who is the Rebbe, they would say the Rebbe's name is Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rebbe Nachum Mendel Schneerson, that's the Rebbe. You would say, where does the Rebbe live? People would say, people have got nothing to do with Lubavitch, where does the Rebbe live? They would say, in New York. What's that? The Rebbe. There are dozens of Rabbeim. There's some very, very great Rabbeim. The Lubavitcher Rebbe Zatzal is unquestionably an exceptionally great man in many, many ways. And many of his own Hasidim don't know how great he was because they don't understand his learning. Many of them don't understand the depth and the wonders of his learning. There are very few people who understand how great he was. But he wasn't the only great one. The Rebbe. There's a Lubavitcher Rebbe. There's a Belzer Rebbe. There's a Geirer Rebbe. There's a Vizhnitzer Rebbe. There was a Klausenberger Rebbe. The Klausenberger Rebbe was a great, great Rebbe. And he was also innovative. Both of them, the common denominator was amazingly innovative people and leaders. Incredible leadership qualities. As the Lubavitcher Rebbe was raised in relatively peaceful circumstances, the Klausenberger Rebbe, Nebuch lost his whole family, his wife and his 10 children in the camps, and spent his early years as Rebbe rebuilding Yiddishkeit in the camps, building mikvos, building yeshivas, building schools in and immediately after the concentration camps, in the transition camps. The moment the war was over, he got together and started building yeshivas, mikvos, shuls, bosei medrash, in the transition camps. And he started bringing people to Torah. And then he established cities in Eretz Israel. There's cities, Kiryat Sanz, wherever there's a Kiryat Sanz, that was created by the Klausenberger Rebbe. In Netanya, in Bnei Brak, in Yerushalayim, in Tzfas, and in many other places. He created towns. He created a hospital. He built in Netanya the only hospital that is 100% Alpi Halacha. Much more so than Shaarei Tzedek. There are two frum hospitals in Eretz Israel. But the Lanyada Hospital in Netanya not only operates according to the letter of Halacha, but it operates according to the soul of Halacha. They were governed by the Klausenberger Rebbe. The doctors, the nurses, the helpers, everybody in that hospital acted on the instructions of the Klausenberger Rebbe. And when all the medical staff were on strike, the medical staff at Lanyada Hospital were not on strike because the Klausenberger Rebbe said no, that was it. And the whole way they treat patients, their whole philosophy is different to any other hospital in the world. That's innovative. He created a hospital that is a model hospital for the world. He created a learning system in the yeshivas. He realized not everybody needs to follow the same learning system. He was the first person to create within his own yeshiva system a dual system of learning. One that emphasized bekius and one that emphasized Iyun, one that emphasized covering a lot of ground, and one that emphasized going into great depth. He instituted exams in his yeshiva, which wasn't done before. This was all innovative. He instituted the Mifal HaShas, where he got people all over the world to learn quantities, to cover ground, because he felt at that time that wasn't being emphasized sufficiently. A great, great leader, a great, great innovator. Why was the Lubavitcher Rebbe so much more controversial than many of the others? I think there are three elements that became controversial. The one was the Torah world questioned to whether this was still innovation or there was beginning to be departure. There was a feeling that some of the innovations were completely innovative. And I had the privilege of spending some time with the Lubavitcher Rebbe quite a while back, some 17 years ago or so, 18 years ago. And I asked him some of these questions. And he said to me, when a fire is burning, you don't follow conventional means. You don't insist on playing by the rules. When a fire is burning, you don't look for qualified firemen. Whoever's capable of handling a bucket of water comes and throws it on the fire. And he said, a fire is burning in the world today. Klal Yisrael is disappearing. We don't follow conventional rules. We have to do whatever needs to be done in order to put the fire out. That was his philosophy. And I remember saying to him, but what happens if the fire is burning in a chemical factory? Not just in a field or in a house. Where throwing water at the wrong time, at the wrong place, can make the whole thing really blow up. He didn't answer. That wasn't his view. It obviously wasn't his view that it was anything dangerous like that. There's a fire burning. There's a crisis on. And it was his belief that certain non-conventional techniques needed to be used in order to counteract the challenge and to counteract the threat that there were. That was his view. Others questioned whether he didn't go too far in innovation or not. That was part of the controversy. And we're living at a time where the world has become, with the Torah world, but not only the Torah world, the whole world, the Torah world as well, has become, as we discussed recently, suspicious of innovation to a point where the danger to the Torah world has become imitation. We are so scared of innovation that we are resorting to imitation. And people who are innovative are automatically at risk in the Torah world. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe was very innovative. That was one of the issues. Another issue, which was perhaps had more basis to it, was there was one thing in which the Lubavitcher Rebbe's style differed from the styles of virtually all other rabbeim. And that was a certain exclusiveness. That what he did for the Lubavitcher movement, and there wasn't that much consultation which with the wider body of Gedolei Yisrael. It was one of the criticisms. He had his reasons for doing it. He believed where he felt that he knew where his priorities lay and what he had to do. And he stayed within his own Daladamas, he stayed within his own defined territory, both physically and spiritually. Didn't go traveling all over the world, didn't go visiting, didn't go to meetings and conferences. That wasn't his style. But he was criticized for that by the others. Whereas the Klausenberger Rebbe, for example, although he was a Rebbe of a specific sect, he used to often meet with the other Gedolei Yisrael and keep up a lot of contact and discussions and consultation with the other Gedolei Yisrael. That was the second cause of the controversy. The third one is a serious one, and that's not a criticism against the Lubavitcher Rebbe Zatzal, but really against the movement, if anything. And that is the PR might have been overdone. There was a view, but one has to realize that's not exclusive to the Lubavitcher movement. There was a view, certainly, I think, what one has to realize is that the concept of PR, of mass communication in Yiddishkeit, was innovated by the Lubavitcher Rebbe and his movement. When he started mass communicating with people, getting the message around vastly right throughout the world, nobody else was doing that. Today lots of people are trying it. And his use of the media, and his use of people, and getting people, getting to influential people, and getting the message across to people, that's something that today everybody else is also following. We're in the time of imitation. So while he and his movement was being criticized for it, it's becoming the norm today with many movements. The PR was criticized on a number of areas, but particularly in more recent times with the whole Mashiach expectation. That the Lubavitcher Rebbe could have been the Mashiach, could have become the Mashiach, is extremely likely. What's equally likely is that there are many other people alive today and who've lived in recent times who also could have become the Mashiach. In terms of the way the Rambam described the prerequisites, Lubavitcher Rebbe was not the only Godel Yisrael descended from the house of David. Lubavitcher Rebbe was not the only Godel Yisrael who had the qualities to be Mashiach if that's what Hashem would have wanted for this period of time. It's possible, it's feasible. But we have to be a little bit careful with the Mashiach issue. One of the criticisms was that Mashiach became popularized to the point where it became an everyday term. It lost some of its kedusha and some of its mystique. People didn't know what Mashiach is. Well, oh, well, we want Mashiach. No, it became a meaningless phrase. It became overused. It became overexposed. That was a criticism. The defense, on the other hand, is there were a whole lot of people who had never heard of Mashiach. And all of a sudden, people had heard it. It was popularized. So you can argue, has it been popularized or has it been cheapened? Two views. And the Lubavitch movement obviously adopted the view that it's being popularized, and the critics of the movement adopted the view that it's been cheapened. But there's a statement of Chazal that Ein ben David bo ad shi yisyashu min hagula. The Mashiach will only come when people stop talking about him. It's a Chazal. And yet that seems to contradict other chazals, that we've got to do so much to bring the Mashiach. What does it mean? Ein Mashiach bo, Mashiach won't come until you stop talking about him. I think we need to understand something which perhaps many haven't understood in the past, and that is that the coming of Mashiach will be a moral epoch. It's a stage in a moral journey, in an ethical journey, in a religious journey. It is not, for example, a stage in a national journey. If we can talk about it as a mistake that the movement made such a thing, it wasn't the Lubavitcher Rebbe himself. There were questions as to why he didn't quell it. He had his reasons for that. But the dynamicism, the energy, he never said he was the Mashiach. The dynamicism and the energy, that came from the movement, from the people around and around. Which is very similar to the dynamics that came among the Zionists in 1948 and before, and in 1967 particularly. In 1967, I was in Israel at the time of the Six-Day War. And people were saying, this is Mashiach's come. Mashiach's here, he's about to come, he is here, he's about to come, 1967. Why? We've got Yerushalayim back, it's the first step to building the Beis HaMikdash. And in the prayer that he said in many shuls today, we talk about the state of Israel as Reishis Tzmichas Geulasein, as the beginning of the coming of Mashiach. The coming of Mashiach must not be pinned on a national or political event. What does it look like now? 1967, we instituted this into the phrases. Reishis Geula, Tzmichas Geula Seinu. This is the beginning of the coming of Mashiach. And now we're busy giving back all the territory that was about to herald the coming of the Mashiach. What's the big deal? Life changes, things come, things go. Don't pin Mashiach on a piece of land. Don't pin Mashiach on a territory. Don't pin Mashiach on a national event, on a political event. That's what it means, Ein ben David bo, ad shi yisyashu mimenu. Focus on the mitzvah, says the Baal HaTanya, says, look at the actions, look at the morality of the people. That's the issue of Mashiach. Not the state of Israel. The state of Israel is irrelevant for Mashiach. When Mashiach comes, we'll have the state of Israel, whether we have it before or we don't have it before. It's not. We don't need it in order to bring Mashiach. We need mitzvahs, we need people thinking correctly, acting correctly, living correctly, operating correctly. That's what has to be in place. We don't need Eretz Yisrael to bring Mashiach, believe it or not. It's very nice to have Eretz Yisrael. It's the other way around. Mashiach brings Eretz Yisrael, not Eretz Yisrael brings Mashiach. We don't have to have a certain amount of territory in the Middle East in order for Mashiach to come. Mashiach will come when the people are right, not when the state is settled. The coming of the Mashiach is not an epoch in any kind of geography. It's not a geographical epoch. And it's not a biographical epoch. It's not a stage in the life of one individual. And that's perhaps, if one can talk about a fault, a mistake of the movement, was pinning the whole concept of Mashiach on one person. That wasn't right. That wasn't fair. Of course he could have been the Mashiach, so could others. And it doesn't matter. That's not the point of focus. The point of messianic focus is me. What am I doing? What am I doing to generate the right kind of world for Mashiach to come? What am I doing with my life to generate the right kind of life for Mashiach to come? What's going on around me? That's where the focus is. We're not meant to focus. We shouldn't be focusing on a nation, on a state, on a piece of territory, or on an individual. We're focusing on a moral concept. A concept that has to be in place before Mashiach can come. And I like to think of it a little bit like scoring in a tennis match or in any kind of game. The score is the important thing. You play to win. But any player who has his eye on the scoreboard is going to lose. The score is Mashiach. We play for Mashiach to come. But if we play with our eye on Mashiach, we're going to lose. Our eye has to be on our actions. Our eye has to be on our lifestyle. Our eye has to be on the way we learn Torah, on the way we teach Torah, on the way we communicate Torah. That's where the eye has to be. Ein ben David bo ad shi yisyashu min ha-geula. Mashiach will only come when we stop looking at the scoreboard. When we stop talking so much about Him, about it, and we start talking about life and about Torah and about what we need to do, then there's a chance that Mashiach will come. That we come closer to the Messianic era. And so clearly, the passing away of these two great Rebbes is a tragedy not only for the movements that they led, but it's a tragedy for the whole of Klal Yisrael. The fact that there's not more knowledge and not more sharing of their greatness is part of the compartmentalization and part of the polarization of modern Jewish life. Part of the intolerance of innovation. Part of the intolerance of diversity. Part of the intolerance of different angles, different views, which really enriches it all. People like to be very stereotyped and very systematic, and they're not willing to think of anything beyond themselves. There's no way Mashiach's going to come as long as we think that way. And perhaps that's one of the lessons that we have to learn. Yes, the Lubavitcher Rebbe could have been the Mashiach. Yes, the Klosenberger Rebbe could have been the Mashiach, and there are others who could be the Mashiach. But we can't be the Messianic age because we're too narrow-minded. We can't be the Messianic age because we're too negative. We're too critical. All we can do is we can look at Lubavitch and figure out what's wrong. All Lubavitch can do is look around at somebody else and figure out what's wrong. I must say, in this entire controversy that went on during the last couple of years, to my knowledge, but that's only my knowledge and I'm not 100% sure of it, but as far as I know, it was a pretty one-sided controversy. Lubavitcher Rebbe never answered, never took part in the controversy. He just went on and did his old thing, his own thing. One has to show an enormous amount of respect for that kind of attitude. Imagine had he responded, and imagine had he argued, imagine what kind of a machlokes there could have been. It was a one-sided machlokes. He kept quiet. That's something that deserves to be celebrated. That's something that deserves to be praised. That's something we need to learn from. That's something we need to take forward. And perhaps what we've got to learn from the passing of great Gedolei Yisrael, whether they're Chassidish Gedolei Yisrael or Misnagdish Gedolei Yisrael, that every time any one of them passes away, we lose a Messianic opportunity. But it's we who've lost the Messianic opportunity. We've lost the Messianic opportunity by focusing on issues outside of ourselves, by focusing on individuals, by focusing on nations, by focusing on viewpoints, by machlokes, by disagreement, by negativism, and by not looking at the wider picture, and by not asking ourselves really what we need to be and what we need to do. One of the questions we're asked after we die, after 120 years, is Sipisol Yeshua. Did you look ahead? Did you look forward? Sipisol means to look over the heads of other people, to look out towards the horizons, to have broad vision. Did you have broad vision in anticipation of the Geula? And ladies and gentlemen, if we're going to learn anything from this and do anything for the coming of Mashiach, the first thing we've got to learn is to break those narrow boundaries and narrow barriers. Yes, we all have our own traditions. Yes, we all have our own Masoris. We come from our own schools, and that's wonderful, and that must be kept. And yes, there's a Klausenberger Hasidus, which is very different to a Lubavitcher Hasidus, which is very different to a Geira Hasidus, which is very different to a Belzer Hasidus, and same all the other Hasidim, and all the different branches of non-Hasidic Hasidic movements. All fine, all okay. As long as they're all genuine, as long as they're all based on Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh, as long as they all accept the written and the oral law, they're all governed by halacha, they're all governed by the Shulchan Aruch and by Shas, as long as they're all authentic, there can be many different diverse opinions and ways of looking at things. But if we're going to do anything to bring the Mashiach, what we need to do is to begin to respect one another, to begin to admire one another's innovativeness, to begin to understand that Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, on the one hand, never deviated from his own tradition in the sense that whatever he said was integral with the way he was taught. But on the other hand, it was always brand new. There was always a new idea, there was always a new an innovation. And as we develop not only a tolerance for diversity, but the ability to celebrate diversity, we will create the environment without focusing on it. Just by focusing on ourselves, we will create the environment for Mashiach to come. And Chazal say that the coming of the Mashiach is one of the things that happen keheref ayin, and it happens very, very suddenly. When least expected, not when expected. When least expected, when we're so busy focusing on ourselves and focusing on one another, when we're so busy developing relationships with one another, admiring, respecting, building one another, then while we're busy in that process with our eye on the ball and off the scoreboard clicks on and on and on, and without even noticing, keheref ayin, like the blink of an eyelid, Mashiach Yirtzeh Hashem will come and will develop us further and take us as a nation to the Geulah HaSidur, to the ultimate redemption.